From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Tim Russert, the longtime host of Meet the Press, passed away Friday. He died of a heart attack at the NBC studios in Washington, D.C. His colleague Tom Brokaw announced the news to a stunned array of journalists, politicians, and fans. Joining me now to remember his life and work is Michelle Norris. She's the host of All Things Considered here on NPR. You've also seen a lot of her this electoral season on Meet the Press. Also with us is Gwen Ifill. She's the moderator and managing editor of the PBS show Washington Week. Michelle, Gwen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Farai.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So I want to start off by asking each of you, how did you meet Tim Russert? Gwen first.
I would say I met Tim Russert 20 years ago covering my very first presidential campaign, and he had just taken over as bureau chief for NBC News in Washington. At the time, he hadn't had a lot of journalism experience, in fact, none. And when he took over, there were a lot of arched eyebrows about whether he was up to this job and whether he deserved it and whether he had the appropriate journalism background. I didn't get to know him really well until I went. I started doing Meet the Press when I was working for the New York Times as an occasional panelist. And then he wooed me to come to work full-time for him at NBC, covering politics, covering Congress, covering campaigns, and basically talked me out of my cushy job at the New York Times and over to NBC News, where he promised that I would be able to do the job I wanted to do, and he kept every single promise he made to me. So we became friends, he became my mentor, he became my boss, and he became just my cut buddy to talk political gossip with. So I'm missing him a lot today.
Before I get to you, Michelle, Gwen, we have heard that he's mentored several people of color, including Suzanne Malveaux, who is now of CNN. What do you think he found in you and Suzanne and the other people he mentored that he really wanted to do, not just for you, but for journalism?
He found people who could tell him things he didn't know. He was a proud Irish Catholic son of Buffalo, New York, with his blue-collar roots, which have been widely documented. But he understood that he didn't know about other people's experiences. And it wasn't like he walked in and said, tell me about black people. It was that he knew if he surrounded himself with enough different kinds of voices who might see something different than he would see in a set of circumstances, that he would learn something new. And he was always kind of excited just to hear something put in a different way or someone bring a different approach or say, or if he loved you, if it seemed like you came also from a lower middle class or poor black background and you could bond over your sameness as much as your difference. So I always found him to be, his curiosity to be the driving force, which led him to bring different kinds of voices into our coverage.
Michelle, you bravely went on All Things Considered to talk about Russert just hours after he had passed away. And for people who are not perhaps as big political junkies as we are, explain why this man, who was named to Time's list of the 100 most influential people worldwide, but why was he so influential?
I think he was influential because of who he was when he sat in that chair on Sunday morning. And the kinds of questions that he asked and the respect and the integrity that he brought to that process. But I think there was something else that he was, you know, Gwen's noted that he came from Irish working class roots. He never forgot who he was. And if you, I just remember running into him, for instance, traveling back and forth on the shuttle between New York and Washington, D.C. And if you were late for a flight, woe to you if you were walking down the hallway with Tim because he was stopped every 15 seconds. And he made time for everyone. He came across not in any way that was grand, but as someone who was very much the common man, someone that people could relate to. And I think he tried very hard to take the political process and make sure that it was understood by the folks who were sitting around in union halls and in bars and in classrooms back home in Buffalo where he came from.
I actually want to play a little bit of you from an appearance that you made on Meet the Press in March. You're talking about Barack Obama and the controversial remarks of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
The sort of fire from the pulpit is not something that is unusual in an African American church. That is some, and in fact in many churches in America. And so what you're dealing with in these statements is in part the words, but also in the way that they were delivered. And you're right in noting that it is very different from what Barack Obama hears, but it's not altogether different from what many people are hearing at this moment in churches all across America.
What allowed you to go on that show and speak not only, you know, in a journalistic tone that might have been more distant, but a journalistic tone that was more friendly or personal, I guess. I'm not sure how to...
To break it down,
sister girl, to break it down. You know, what was it about this show that allowed you to be your full self?
Oh, it was Tim. And Gwen has had these moments also, because I've had experiences watching her on Sunday morning where she starts to say something and everybody else in the room sort of sits back in their chair and just watches because they're not sure that they have anything to contribute on this point. It's what Gwen said, that Tim had a way of, he knew what he didn't know, and he surrounded himself with people who could bring a new perspective to the table. And part of it was that it was a conversation. It wasn't an inquisition. Sitting at Tim's table felt like you were almost at his dining room table in his home or something. He really did want to hear from you. And he cherished the fact that you brought something different to the table, that you brought a different experience. And in that moment, and following up on that clip, David Broder and David Gregory were also on that program. And David Broder scratched his head and said, you know, but I just don't understand how a guy like Barack Obama could, you know, could go to a church that was presided over week in and week out by this man who speaks like this. And normally that would have been a cue for the moderator, for Tim, to jump in and take over the conversation. And in that moment, Tim turned to me and without saying anything, said, you're on board. You know, this is your time to explain this.
And the other thing, go ahead.
He knew when to step forward. He knew when to step back.
Well, and the other thing, Farai, is that it was a safe place to go. If you're a straight-ahead reporter like Michelle and I, we're not pundits, we're not people who tell you what you ought to think, we're not, you know, grandiose opinion meisters. So we knew that was a safe place where we would go. Tim wouldn't, like, point his finger at us and ask us to make predictions about what are you going to do next, and he wouldn't do any of that. He could take pains to treat us as reporters who are bringing information to the table, not pundits who are just popping off based on what they had read in the paper 5 minutes before. He knew there was a place for that. In fact, he told people he knew that some people had that job and he had a different job. And if you tried to get Tim to say what he thought, he would change the subject faster than the speeding bullet.
I was at a barbecue this weekend and someone said to me, you know, I'm essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, I'm tired of people just saying nice things about Tim Russert. I feel like political journalists who are in the center like him are not tough enough on the politicians. Gwen, what would you say to that?
I'd say they didn't watch Meet the Press because, yeah, there's sure there are a lot of people out there who are more interested in telling you their opinions than in grilling the people who hold the levers of power, but I never saw anybody grill a politician like Tim Russert. I don't think any politician who ever went on Meet the Press ever felt like they were treated with a soft hand, and he had enough time that he would grill, and it was a great frustration to his producers because they'd say, you have 10 minutes, Tim, and Tim would go on for 14 if he didn't think he was getting the answer. Sure, there are a lot of shortcomings in what we do in our business, and my great fear and grief is that that's going to be a bigger shortcoming with Tim's loss, because I think he absolutely goes down with the reputation of being someone who really grilled, who was really tough. I know it can seem from a distance, and I'm aware of this myself because of my personal connection with Tim, that we can go overboard in praising someone. But I don't think it's too much to say. I know this from all my friends who work at the NBC News Bureau, all the journalists I know who've ever been on Meet the Press, that they're feeling this today, this real gap in how we're going to cover this campaign without someone whose job it is to hold down, to be the ballast, to hold down the middle without telling you what to think or expressing opinion or doing the quick whip around, just really boring in. And that's what Tim did.
You know, I have to just add something there, Farai. Tim also taught us something. Gwen and I both interview people in what we do. We both, you know, sit at a table also and question people about their jobs, their policies. And one of the things that Tim taught us is you can be tough and still exhibit grace. You know, when people criticize and raise these kind of comments, they're saying, well, he wasn't tough enough. He didn't grill them. He didn't bore down hard enough on people. I would invite them to sit down and watch his interview with President Bush, where he asked a simple question, was this a war of choice or a war of necessity? I would ask them to sit down and look at his interview with David Duke, mm-hmm. where when David Duke said, I'm not running on race, I'm running on the economy, and he asked a series of respectful questions, measured questions. He didn't necessarily bore down or beat him up, but he made clear that David Duke said he was running on economic issues, but actually knew very little about the economic issues that actually touched the lives of people in Louisiana.
when you think about this election, which is, I mean, to call it unprecedented would be an understatement. How do you think this is going to change the coming months we have of coverage until the moment when all is said and done? Michelle first.
You mean how I think Tim's passing will change this?
Yes.
NBC has, boy, they have a tough choice to make, you know, in deciding who actually sits in that chair. But Tim left a legacy that many people will look to inside NBC and out of NBC. And the one thing, I'm not going to make predictions because that's not generally what I do, but I will say this. I will miss, I just miss him in general, but I'll miss the way he asked questions. I'll also miss the joy that he brought to the process. This was someone who was as enthusiastic about this election as anyone I have ever met. You'd sit at his table, and when they'd go to commercial break, he'd turn to you and he'd say, "Can you believe what's going on?" I mean, you saw that if you watched him on Sunday mornings. You saw that if you watched him in the course of the cable coverage. You saw that if you watched him in the Today Show coverage. And he reminded us every day that we have the best jobs in America. We sit at the front seat of history, and boy, I'll miss him for that.
Gwen?
Well, and the other thing is, we've all lived long enough to know that no one person is the only person who can do a job. I mean, it's always alarming how quickly, you know, the water closes over your head once you step out of the tub. You know, that's a terrible metaphor, but you know where I'm going. I think that it's possible that Tim, I don't think he'll be replaced, but that somebody will step in and we will ask the right questions. And this campaign is too consequential, and there are too many important issues to get to for the questions not to be asked. They will be asked, but not quite the same way. And Michelle is right. You know, right now, every part of the media industry is under siege. We just heard today that McClatchy Newspapers is cutting back 10%, mm-hmm. hundreds and hundreds of jobs at their newspapers around the country. That's hundreds and hundreds of people who aren't doing it the same. So I worry about what happens without Tim.
All right, ladies, thank you so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Thank you, Farai.
We were speaking with Michelle Norris of NPR's All Things Considered and Gwen Ifill of the PBS show Washington Week about Tim Russert. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Some of us wake up every morning and wonder, what will the gas pump say today? Crude oil hits new highs as it closes in on $140 a barrel. But how does that number translate into consumer gas prices? The national average price for consumers is a record $4.08 per gallon, and prices at the pump are expected to keep climbing. But what else should you look for before filling up the tank? To help us answer this, we have economist Keith Reed. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer and writes a finance blog for BET called Dollar Out of 15 Cents. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Farai. How you doing?
I'm doing great. So it seems like every morning the signs for gas prices are a couple cents higher than the night before. So are we going to see $5 a gallon gas?
I think it's possible. There's no way of really knowing. It'll just all, of course, the price of a gallon of gasoline is going to depend on a number of factors. The number one factor, obviously, is going to be the price of crude oil, which really hasn't let up in its long-term increases over the last about 2 years. Then you're going to start to look back and see what happens with the weather, what happens with even terrorism in other countries. And what I mean by weather, if you think back to Hurricanes Katrina and Rita that threw some of the production facilities in the Gulf offline, if you don't have the ability to do the refining, then you see some increases in the production costs, and therefore that's reflected. You've got to worry about the geopolitical situations in other countries. When you look at some countries in Africa, when you look at some countries in South America that supply a lot of the oil that we get, and obviously you always want to be worried about what's going on in the Middle East. Any hurricanes, any terrorist attacks, anything of that nature could affect whether or not these gas prices continue to rise. And even absent many of those special events we've seen for the last two and a half years, just a consistent rise in the cost of crude oil. So I don't know that there's any relief coming in these prices anytime soon.
You have been doing some interesting work on this whole gas issue, including issues like theft. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about some of the things you've seen?
This morning I posted on my blog a quick post based off a Newsweek article that someone emailed me talking about the actual increase in theft of gasoline. Now, what do I mean by theft? There was actually one anecdote that they used of a situation where two men pulled up to a gas pump, tinkered with it, waited until they figured out how to get this thing started without using a credit card, without using cash, got the pump started, and then a few minutes later, a line of cars pulled into the gas station, and everybody started filling up their pumps and paying the guys who had hijacked the machine itself. It sounded like something out of a movie. It was a very organized operation. But you're seeing this stuff starting to happen more and more, both on a very organized level and just with individuals, with people who will pull into a gas station. They won't pay for the gas. Some gas stations, there are still gas stations that are out there in some sections of the country, especially in the Midwest and even in the South, where you can pull into a gas station, pull up to the pump, and not pay before you get the gas. And so if you're not paying before you pump, you can just leave theoretically without paying for the gas and get away with it. And you're starting to see that more and more.
What about issues like credit cards and debit cards? There are all sorts of rules. And I know that I've learned about a couple of them only as I've sort of made my way up to the little plexiglass booth. So tell us what's going on with those.
Well, here's the deal. If you are carrying a debit card that has a Visa or a MasterCard symbol on it, when you go to use that card, whether you're at a store or a gas pump, if you choose debit, there's always a fee associated with one of those cards. Now, they'll ask you debit or credit. If you say debit, you pay the fee. If you say credit, the gas station or the retailer pays the fee. When people are paying for gas with their credit cards, it is costing that gas station a percentage of the cost of that gallon of gas to pay Visa or MasterCard or whoever the card issuer is for that transaction. What that means is that their costs are going up as the price of gas is going up. And in most cases, when you're dealing with a gas station that is also a retailer, which means that it's a convenience store operator that also sells gas. Gas is considered a loss leader, meaning they lose money on the sale of every gallon of gas that they make, but they only have gas there to get you to come into the store. So they're already losing money. Now they're losing more money because people are walking up, they're paying for gasoline with credit because they don't have cash, or they're choosing credit because they know that they don't want to pay the fee on their debit card, and that's starting to cost more and more money. So some of these gas station operators are actually starting to put some restrictions on the use of your credit card or your method of payment when you buy gas at their station.
Now, what would the downside of that be?
Well, first and foremost, some of them are starting to ban outright or starting to put a limit on how much gas you can buy when you use that credit card. That's going to be the most immediate impact of this. If you walk up to the gas station and they say you can't pay with credit anymore because it's costing us too much to pay for your transaction if you're using a credit card. In some other instances, they're simply tacking on a surcharge. You may pay a different price at that gas station if you buy the same gallon of gas at the same grade with cash as opposed to using an actual credit card.
So does that mean that right now cash is really what you should be headed for? Because I know a lot of times, for example, there are affinity cards that promise you everything from a clock radio to airline miles if you use a credit card. And if you are someone who uses your credit card responsibly, you can maybe get a vacation out of it. But it sounds like that may not be the gas station may not be a place to add to your miles or whatever it is you're getting.
Well, pay attention to the terms of your credit card and pay attention to the terms of your purchase. A lot of times these gas stations that are putting in some new rules are making exceptions for carrying their own affinity card. So if you're using, obviously, if you go to an Exxon gas station and you're carrying an Exxon credit card, or a BP station carrying a BP card, they don't want to discourage you from using that card that they're actually getting some money off the interest from. So then they won't put that restriction on. But you always want to know the terms under which you're making a purchase on credit, regardless of what you're buying and where you're buying it.
Now, what about gas prices internationally? We've talked a lot about what's going on in America, but sometimes if you read about what people pay in other countries, you will be kind of amazed and get a whole second wave of sticker shock. So what are some of the gas prices in developed Western countries, for example?
I mean, if you were to go to any of the European Union countries right now, and I haven't checked their prices this morning, so I can't give you a quote, but I can tell you that for the longest time they have paid much more than we've paid for gasoline here in the United States, and they continue to do so, which is why in some parts you see some of those nations have a much more intricate system of rail, for example, which is something that you're hearing talked about more and more here in the United States as the cost of gas goes up. But in many European nations and many developed Western nations, they're already outside of the United States. They're already paying far more for gas than we are. And some of this is sort of to them, it's like, yeah, right, Americans, come on, you pay, you know, so much less for gas than we already do. Give me a break. We don't really care how much you pay for gas.
It's a little bit of a chicken and egg, though, with public transportation, because here in the U.S., there may be people who want to take public transportation, but they don't have access. And so they can't even go about, you know, they're too far, for example, out in the suburbs or exurbs or rural areas to really make use of it and therefore have to pay those high gas prices. Isn't that true?
That is true. A story on CNN Money this morning actually talked about that. That phenomenon of people considering or actually moving to be closer to where they work because they're doing so much commuting. And I blogged about this again. I moved 7 months ago from Boston which is a city that has a pretty efficient subway, to Cincinnati, which is a city that really has no significant public transportation to speak of. I mean, there are buses, but that's really so much different from having a subway system. And here, the difference in what you pay to drive is not only going to be in the cost of that gallon of gas, but in how much you have to pay just to get to and from work, because Midwestern cities and Southern cities and cities out on the West Coast simply were not built for commuters in the way that Northeastern cities were. There are no subways. There aren't public transportation, bus systems, inner city rail. All of those things simply don't exist in the interior or in the Western quarter of the 48 states. And so you're out here now, you're paying $4 a gallon for gas, where it was just over a dollar not that many years ago. You're paying almost three times as much as it is for gas, and you have to drive everywhere. It's almost unimaginable to somebody who grew up and who lived in East Coast cities for most of his life, like I did, and you can't, now you live out here and you got to pay so much more money for gas. It makes you consider whether or not you want to move downtown. You want to live, do you really want to live 20 or 30 miles from work and make that drive to and from every day with gas being $4, more than $4 a gallon?
And there's parking so often when you get to work. There's something else going on that is really interesting, which is that car companies are changing the models that they're making and discounting the models on the lots, as well as used car dealers sharply discounting the models there. So what do you see ahead on that score?
Well, what's essentially happening is this is the ripple effect. The price of gas has gone up to the extent that people simply aren't interested in SUVs. One big barometer, I think, that people have always talked about, some economists have talked about, and people who follow the auto industry, has been when people get sick of driving gas guzzlers in this country, then we'll know that gas simply costs too much. And we're starting to reach that point. There are huge waiting lists for hybrids, and not in more liberal states where people are concerned with being green, but in some of these Midwestern and in some of these Southern states where people, by and large, don't really worry about the environment so much. They're concerned about how much they're paying. It's hitting their pocketbooks. Well, what does that mean? That means that GM wants to get out of the business of selling a gas guzzler like the Hummer. They're considering cutting that model completely from their production line. It means that if you are going to buy a used car, and so many people bought these big gas guzzlers, these big SUVs that get, you know, abysmal gas mileage, abysmal miles to the gallon, that you walk into a used car dealership, they can't move that car, so they're offering you an incentive. They're giving you a gas card. They're giving you a year's worth of fill-ups on them, just because they need to be able to move that inventory off the lot and bring in something new.
Keith, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Farah.
We've been speaking with Keith Reed. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer and blogs for BET's finance page, Dollar Out of 15 Cents. He joins us from member station WGUC in Cincinnati, Ohio. Obama gives a Father's Day speech telling fathers to be more involved in their children's lives and not guilty. That was the R. Kelly verdict handed down by a Chicago jury Friday afternoon. And those are the topics for this week's Bloggers Roundtable. Joining me are Jay Smooth, who blogs at illdoctrine.com, Danny Perry, who blogs at therealready.blogspot.com, and Eric Brown, who blogs at detroitnews.com. Thanks for coming, guys.
Thank you.
So let's start out with R. Kelly. He was acquitted on all charges of child pornography. Reports say he cried when he heard the verdict. What was your reaction, Eric?
Well, he should have cried. I happen to have seen the video, and was that him? I would have to say yes. And for him to get acquitted on all 14 counts, I would have cried like a baby, too. Because he escaped going to jail for possibly 15 years.
Danny, what do you think it says about the prosecutors? Were they the ones who dropped the ball in this very complicated case where people said, oh, that was the girl, it wasn't her, it's been so many years? Did the prosecutors drop the case? Was R. Kelly lucky? What happened?
Well, it's hard to say. I personally didn't see the video, but the question is, how did it take 6.5 years to get to this point? With the prosecution with as much evidence as they supposedly had, how was the defense able to even impart reasonable doubt in this case? Ultimately, it hinged on the identity his and of his alleged victim. The fact that she didn't testify, her family was split on whether or not it was her in the video. The defense was able to create reasonable doubt. So R. Kelly, he had his day in court. He was found not guilty. But having not seen the tape, I won't speculate on whether or not it was him. But again, with this level of evidence, I think. Questions regarding the prosecution are legitimate at this point.
J. R. Kelly has a history of being involved with underage girls. He, according to court records, in 1994, married the late singer Aaliyah. He was 27. She was 15. The marriage license was reportedly falsified to show that she was 19 years old. Of course, she later died tragically and was widely mourned. But by that time, their marriage was annulled. Does his history have an influence on not this case, which is over, but on how people perceive him, Jay?
I think, there's a lot of division on that. There are many people whose perception of him is definitely clouded by that, and I don't think they're ever able to look at him the same way. Then there are a lot of people who they enjoy his music and have a connection to him on that level, and somehow they're able to block out all these issues, even though they're impossible to avoid. And it really surprises me because, I mean, certainly there are many artists, let's say Miles Davis was known for being abusive towards the women in his life, but when you listen to a Miles Davis record, you're not really hearing that part of him on the song, whereas when you listen to R. Kelly, I feel like all of his lyrics are so campy and sort of borderline sleazy. It's almost as if you're being exposed to the same part of his psyche that you are in all of these rumors and cases that you hear about. So the fact that so many people are able to sort of compartmentalize and say that they don't think he should be held accountable for his actions because we like all his hit records so much, it makes me wonder if our relationship with the media has really taken a strange turn these days.
Danny, do you think that people should be responsible for what they listen to, as in, don't buy any records if you think the guy's sleazy?
Well, yeah, the short answer to that is yeah. And this society there's an ongoing sexualization of the whole society. And with cameras and phones and just the internet and the ability to post these types of videos, I think there are going to be more of these cases coming down the pipe. And with young victims of this age, they're impressionable. They're starstruck in many cases. And the fact that the popular music pretty much is all about sex at this point in time, it's difficult enough to raise your, particularly daughters, in the right way when you're competing against popular music. So I think it's up to parents to really watch what they allow their kids to listen to in front of them. And there is in my opinion, I won't buy it if the lyrics are questionable.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We are back with our Bloggers Roundtable. Joining me, Jay Smooth, who blogs at illdoctrine.com, Danny Perry of therealready.blogspot.com, and Eric Brown, who blogs at detroitnews.com. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Yesterday was Father's Day, and Barack Obama took absentee black fathers to task Sunday during an address at Chicago's popular South Side Church. He said the government has to do more to help struggling American families, but he also said that fathers must do more to raise their children. Here's a soundbite from his speech.
If we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that too many fathers are also missing. Too many fathers are MIA. Too many fathers are AWOL, missing from too many lives and too many homes. They've abandoned their responsibilities. They're acting like boys instead of men.
Jay, was he channeling Bill Cosby? No, what I mean by that is that he is someone who's known for a certain type of oratory, and this was a slightly different kind of oratory. What do you make of it?
I did find it somewhat reminiscent of what we've heard from Bill Cosby, but I'd say the more recent incarnation of Bill Cosby's message in the book that he put out with Alvin Poussaint, because at first Bill Cosby was coming out very, very strongly against young black men in a way that alienated a lot of people because it didn't seem to place it in the context of all the structural inequalities that black men are also facing that factors into that. But in his more recent messages, Bill Cosby has sort of found more of a balance of acknowledging both the personal responsibility and each individual black man's shortcomings within that, and also sort of the institutional racism and inequalities that factor into that. So I feel like it did somewhat remind me of Bill Cosby's message, but I think Barack Obama is doing a good job of walking that tightrope where you don't want to seem like you're blaming everything on the system, but you don't want to seem as if you're throwing black men under the bus either. I mean, I thought it was a very good speech in that regard.
Eric, what did you think?
I concur with what Jay said, because I did not get to hear the full speech until today. One of the local radio stations here played it, and I was able to listen to it on my way to work. And the key to the speech is, as Jay said, he did not paint all black men with the same brush by throwing them under the bus. And, you know, every time you hear Barack Obama give a speech of significance, go back to his speech on race, you just learn more about him as a person. You appreciate him as a person. And even today, I'm looking forward to driving down to Detroit to see him this evening, because he, without a doubt, should become the next president of this country, not just because of who he is, but how he presents himself. And that speech that he gave yesterday was reminiscent of something that was necessary at the right time. And what better day and time to give a speech like that than Father's Day?
You know, I noted that he talked a little bit about his own father walk, his own path with his father, and he really has used his own story, his own narrative, to reshape how he deals with people. Danny, do you find that effective?
Well, I think it's very effective, particularly the speech yesterday. When you look at the statistics, all of them show that single-parent households are just dramatically more likely to be poverty-stricken. The percentage of incarcerated men who grew up in fatherless households, it tells the same story. High school dropouts, long-term unemployed, you get the same answers. It's the same story in almost every case. If the dad is there, the percentages are dramatically different. So you can't really underestimate the importance that a father brings to a household, and you can't underestimate the burden on single mothers and extended families is due to the absence of fathers in the household. And someone like Barack Obama, he overcame it and has succeeded beyond all measure. However, there are a lot of young men and families that don't due to that particular reason, the father just not being there.
You know, I want to move on to a different topic, which is how things are playing out on the internet, because there is all this storytelling, which Barack Obama has done about himself. Senator John McCain has done about himself. They each have their own websites. Plus, you know, there are all these supporter sites and party sites. Now, you know, we've been talking a little bit about this new site, FightTheSmears.com, which is a Barack Obama site trying to deal with attacks on himself and his wife. Do you think that it's smart Danny, to go ahead and to create your own kind of truth squad or rebuttal, or does it just open you up to charges of being oversensitive in a political environment where many things are fair game?
Well, I think it's smart. All you have to do is look at the Gore and Kerry campaigns to see what can happen if you sit back and let your opponents paint the picture of you for you. So the Fight the Smears, I think it's a good start. And there are some other grassroots sites like the MichelleObamaWatch.com that have also rallied to this cause. And it demonstrates that he, as a candidate, is not content to be painted by his opponent, and that he's actually going to fight to win this nomination and to get keep this campaign focused on issues.
Eric, is there a chance that it could backfire? Because some of the many charges that you hear are the Obamas are too sensitive. When Senator Obama said, "Lay off my wife," on national television, for example.
I don't think it would backfire at all. As a matter of fact, John Kerry is not in the White House right now because he was able to allow himself to be portrayed as a wimp when the 527 started doing all this negative advertising for him. And one thing that the Obama camp is doing, they are providing an opportunity for people to see truth to power. A lot of people don't watch Fox News. A lot of people don't read newspapers and magazines. They are able to go to a website to learn what has been said, and these websites are giving people an opportunity to combat that. Unfortunately, John Kerry did not have the wherewithal or the intuitive skills to do something like this. I think it's going to be very powerful.
Now, what do you think, Jay, of John McCain's ability not just to create his own web properties, but to also leverage what's being called viral media? You know, we talk a lot about Senator Barack Obama because he has been good at this, on our Bloggers Roundtable. But there's no law that says that Senator Barack Obama has to remain better on this. There are both campaigns and many outsiders trying to make sure that they have a stake in the kind of digital marketing of the presidency. What do you see that's going on that's particularly noteworthy from Republicans or conservatives?
I mean, certainly I think there's a great deal for the McCain campaign to tap into. I mean, there's a very strong conservative blogger presence out there, and many very influential conservative websites, but of course it'll be difficult to build alliances with sites without connecting with sites that have certain messages that the McCain campaign might find themselves apologizing for later on. So it'll definitely be a tight walk for them, and I think a tightrope walk, I should say. And I think it'll be a little more difficult for McCain to come across as credible as being a big internet player, because when you hear Barack Obama speak about these things, he refers to YouTube and things like that as if he's actually conversant and uses those things. And I think it'll be a little harder for John McCain to be credible suggesting that he's Twittering and instant messaging or what have you.
All right. Well, if you want to Twitter us anytime, you just go on my Facebook page. John McCain can Twitter me. We want him on. Barack Obama, too. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joining me was Jay Smooth. He blogs at illdoctrine.com and joined us from the NPR studios in New York City. Danny Perry, he blogs at therealready.blogspot.com. He was at KPFT Radio in Houston, Texas. And Eric Brown, who blogs at detroitnews.com. Superheroes come in all forms. Some are supersized, muscular, and green. Others dress like a bat. But now some are battling a life-threatening virus, AIDS. Illustrator Robert Walker created the comic book superheroes called O-Men. Robert is here now to tell us about his imaginative attempt to raise AIDS awareness through comic books. Welcome, Robert.
Hey, hi. How's it going?
This is really a fascinating take on the whole genre of comic books, which have been popular for decades. If you count far back enough to the cave paintings, probably millennia. But, this is the story of a group of people with HIV. An experimental AIDS antidote gives them superpowers unexpectedly. And the kind of plot line that you're talking about is also unexpected. So why did you choose it?
Well, I chose it because I thought that there should be more of a push of AIDS awareness in our community, because there's a growing influx, growing population of people being infected, more at an alarming rate than it has been in history. Amongst those that are the highest is amongst young people from the ages of 16 to about 23 or 26. So I thought, and from through my experience growing up, I've had experience with people being infected and dying around me from the disease. So I felt it very important to use my talents to try to advocate AIDS awareness to help the society itself.
Now, let me describe, a couple of images here. I mean, you could probably do a much better job than I could. These are not, there's a lot of wonderful educational comic books that are very, I would say, PG or PG-13. But here you have, at the start, you have one of your superheroes comparing being a superhero to having AIDS, in the sense that both were life events that were completely unexpected. And, the power of this superhero, there's no question from looking at it that this is not, this is just not a little cuddly superhero. This is a butt-kicking superhero. You also have scenes further on where you see characters, two male characters in bed with each other. You see people making out in a club. You talk about the ways that people got the disease, and you depict them. Who's your audience for this, given that some of your content is mature?
I would say from the ages of 12, when you start puberty, on up. I wouldn't give it to a toddler or anyone, preschooler. But I guess starting the age of teenage years on up, because those are the people that are susceptible to the disease if they're sexually active. And so I am very direct when I do a comic book about HIV and AIDS. I want it to be very direct and very not cutting around the corners, and be very right at focus of what AIDS is, how do you get it, and how can you prevent it, or how can you deal with it if you have it.
How do you plan on distributing this so it reaches people who may love comic books, but other people who may be non-traditional members of your audience?
Well, I'm growing. I want to try to get in Barnes & Noble and put like a collection of books together, like a collection of issues, and do like a more of a, almost like a novel of a comic book novel, like a graphic novel, like get 6 issues and maybe distribute them in Barnes & Noble's. And just also just really put it into places as maybe try to get them into educational programs in school, maybe hopefully and incorporate them in like classes such as sexual behavior study classes or whatever they may have you.
And in the book, in the comic, you already have a comic, and then you have additional resources. Why did you, clearly it must be something that you felt was important to put additional resources that were not related to the comic but related to the AIDS issue at hand.
Well, I thought if I'm going to tackle the issue of AIDS and HIV in a comic book, I also wanted to give resources for the reader, if I'm going for HIV/AIDS awareness, to have the tools to be aware. So I have a lot of contributors who, especially one, his name is Dr. Howard Grossman. He's a MD HIV specialist. And I correspond with him a lot, and he's also volunteers his writing or his thoughts or his services to me to lend himself to the book to give like real solid education or knowledge that he has to put into the book so people can have knowledge about it as well that read it. And I thought, the main important thing is a lot of people that need to do is to get tested. Because a lot of people don't know that they are infected, and that's how it spreads. So that was another thing that I put in the comic book, which is hotlines and services, which I have listed about 2 pages, and it'll be in each and every issue to where you can get find out where you can get free rapid testing, or where you can find out where you can get support groups or hotlines about HIV. So, okay.
Your new book, Omen Positive, the next comic in the series is slated to come out next month. So what can we look forward to?
The new issue that's coming out is even more of in-depth look about HIV and AIDS and the superheroes themselves. I wanted to show the superheroes in a good light, but I also didn't want to show HIV and AIDS and glamorize it and say, oh, if I'm a superhero, I wanted to, you know, I need to, I could have AIDS and be like, fine. So what I did was incorporate the superhero, but have them have HIV in real life situations if a person were to have it. So they would have the same illnesses, the same sicknesses, and even some of the characters may die from HIV, may die from AIDS or something like that. So the book really shows you, I have in one scene where you see one of the characters is about to have sexual relations with a woman, and I show a condom. I talk about...
I'm sorry, we have to wrap it up here. There's so much to talk about, but thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Robert Walker is the creator and illustrator of the Omen series about HIV-positive superheroes, and he joined us from our NPR studios in New York City.